There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me?
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now, on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
So many simply incredible places to see.
Leslie Crutchfield with us. She's the co-author of Do More Than Give, The Six Practices of Donors Who Change the World. She's an author. She's a leading authority on scaling social innovation and high-impact philanthropy. She's a senior advisor at FSG, a nonprofit consulting firm specializing in social sector strategy, evaluation, and research. Her previous book, Forces for Good, was recognized in The Economist on its annual list of top business books. And let's say, Leslie, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Do More Than Give, The Six Practices of Donors Who Change the World. Now, when we talk change the world, what does it take to be a donor?
Well, to be a donor, it can mean giving charity to nonprofits, whether you're an individual. It can be a foundation, you know, big foundations like the Gates Foundation, obviously the largest philanthropy in the world. And in our book, Do More Than Give, the research, we looked at a wide range of foundations, some families that are relatively small. You know, they don't have the billions that the Gates have to give away, and yet they've had extraordinary high levels of impact. And we look at all kinds of donors, big or small. The smaller ones really punch above their weight.
Yeah. Now, by the way, one of the things that we do have to look at In giving today, especially when we talk about philanthropy, the act of giving, it's really hasn't moved much. And because of this very, I would call it a unsure economy and global unsure economy, not just here, people are very weary of putting money out today. And is there anything that we can do to get this to stop? Because those people who are philanthropists, who put their money in the right spot, save lives, move us forward, and do all of the things that we can't do without them.
It's so true. And with the, you know, government cutbacks that are coming down the pike, the nonprofits that deliver so many of the needed services for people that are out of work, in trouble, need that kind of support, are going to see some serious budget cuts. So now more than ever, we're looking to philanthropy to fill the gaps. And at the same time, you know, still climbing out of the recession, most foundation endowments took a 30% more hit, and individual portfolios, everybody's feeling much more tight and strapped, as you say. At the same time, I will say that, you know, America in particular is a really generous place. By far the largest amount of giving happens here, perhaps because of our unique culture and our commitment to nonprofit and volunteer organizations. That's really part of our kind of founding heritage. And obviously we're, you know, relative to many countries in the world, a very well-off country. The average American household gives about $1,500 to charity a year.
Sure.
We're quite generous. And people try and do that in good times or bad. Now, the question for the bigger foundations, the ones that are giving, let's say, $1 million or even $1 billion away a year, how do you get the most out of those dollars? And that's what we looked at in our research for Do More Than Give. And the answer at a high level is that the best donors, they definitely give money and they're continuing to make donations, but they use their networks, their know-how. They go beyond funding direct service organizations to advocate for policy changes, and they do a whole host of things, the six practices that we write about in the book, that get more bang for their buck.
You really, realistically, when you take a look at it, I think that is the operative word I'm going to use, say social networking. That's really what they're doing, which has come to the fore so strong that it has in the last 7 or 8 years. We really didn't understand it 10 years ago. But I want to talk about the word leader. You know, the word leader, there's many, many different definitions of a leader, but a philanthropist also has to be, in and of themselves, some way to pass it on to the leader. They're not necessarily the leader, but the leader of the organization, they've got to be able to trust. They'll be able to trust in such a way that they know when the dollars are put out, it's going to go where it's going to go. What do we look at in a leader today? Is there anything, is there any structure to a leader that we should see and or one that we could be wary of?
Well, the kinds of leaders that we studied in the book are what we call adaptive leaders. And by that, you know, it's kind of the opposite of the command and control types of, you know, militaristic models or in the old kind of big industrial companies. Instead, adaptive, we mean that they're looking for solutions to problems, and then these leaders find people in the community to go out and solve the problems for themselves. So, you know, if it's a problem with a shortage of jobs, one of the great examples is the Boston Foundation in Massachusetts. The CEO of that foundation, Paul Grogan, you know, said, we've got to get all of the leaders across the city of Boston to help come up with solutions. And typically a foundation might fund, let's say, a job training program, help out-of-work adults find the skills to get digital economy jobs. But if you train all the workers in the world, if they're not, the jobs aren't there for them to take, and career opportunities that can help them live above, you know, the very minimum wage poverty level, then they're not going to be able to support their families and succeed. So Grogan actually went out to the businesses in Boston, and they have a huge healthcare industry there. He convened all the chiefs of the major hospitals, most of which are for-profit now, and said, you know, let's have a challenge and see who can come up with the best work programs for low-wage or entry-level workers. And they set up a competition, and now they've helped create thousands of jobs and pull many people up into more secure, you know, career and employment situations. And it's because instead of the foundation saying, well, we're going to be the lead and do this, they got everybody to join in and be part of the solution.
Now, by the way, when you talk about that collective solution, that collaboration, I think more and more today we're beginning to realize that one person alone truly can't do it. There's an old adage that I've lived my life by for quite a number of years now. And Leslie, it's a good leader knows when to be a follower and a good teacher knows when to be a student. And I think when you're talking about adaptive leaders, they fall right into that category, right into that definition, because they know that if things aren't working, if things aren't moving forward, step back, see what you don't see. Take a look at the foundation that causes you to make the decisions that you make. And then when you've got something called an adaptive leader, and I know you talk about that in the book, but the adaptive leader is somebody who's flexible enough to realize that the focus is on the goal and not themselves. You were talking about that leader that took charge, yada, yada. Most of those kind of leaders are about themselves.
Right. You know who writes about this? I'm a big fan of his work, Jim Collins, who wrote the business management books like Good to Great and Co-wrote Built to Last. And he talks about the level five leader being kind of the highest order of leader, where it's not about me, the CEO, it's about what's best for the company, what's best for the mission. In the philanthropy world, it's what's best for the cause. It's not so much about me. And to the idea of this collective impact, one of the adages that I like to quote along the lines of yours, which are terrific, is it's amazing how much you can get done if you don't care about who gets the credit.
No, absolutely. And I think that's really the key. And we're moving more and more to that because the old way of doing it doesn't seem to work. There was a time when there was a way of doing it and it was, and there was boundaries on it. There are no boundaries now. When we have to look at something, you look at something not just locally and nationally, but you've got to look at it multinationally now, because if you don't, you're going to lose out very quick to someone else.
I agree.
Yeah. Now, by the way, the philanthropists in and of themselves, when you look at people like the Bill Gateses, what do they move to? What is it that would cause people like that to bring their money into a certain area?
Well, the Gates Foundation is actually one of the case studies in our book. And I will say one thing that they're doing right, and a lot of other foundations could do very well to move in this direction, is they've focused on just a couple key causes. So even though Gates Foundation has billions in assets, they've said, we're going to target solving global health problems, like ending malaria, and reforming and improving U.S. schools. So if you think about it, there's thousands of causes out there, hunger, homelessness, the arts, everything imaginable, and they're all important. But Gates, instead of doing what a typical foundation does, which is give grants and do a lot of funding and dozens and dozens of different areas, they said, we're going to pick two problems and we're going to try and solve it. And that's what we recommend donors do, because once you get focused and try and start solving a problem, then you do research. You understand which organizations are effective, who you should partner with, which solutions are working, what's not working, and you really start to get traction. And then you can really get closer to solving it. And that's what these donors are, they're really driven by results.
Now, one of the key concerns, I would imagine, when it comes to results, you got to take a look at the world today. Business changes, you've got political influence in what you do, and there's so many different forces that you have to take a look at to combine them all together and find your way down the middle to be able to maneuver your way through. It's not just, here's some money, go do the job. There are so many challenges and roadblocks that any philanthropist is going to be taking a look at when they get into the nonprofit, the 501(c), whoever it is they're going to give money to. So there are all these things to take a look at today, and there is a bureaucracy that it seems to stand in the way of really moving through those challenges and getting to do what you want to do.
Yeah, and by the way, some of these foundations do have a big bureaucracy, but most of the groups we studied, they don't even really have staff. They might have one full-time staff person. So they're getting a lot done with a very, very limited staff, and they're looking for highly leveraged ways to get results. You know, they're looking for those tipping points like Malcolm Gladwell writes about.
Now, let me ask you this, and I think it happens with every author, a co-author, author something, whether it's fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be. When you decide to go after something, research something, put something to pen, you think you know about it. And then there's that point in the writing and in the research that there's that epiphany, there's that aha moment when you begin to realize there's more to it than you thought. Where was that for you?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Well, one of the practices that was kind of the most interesting and counterintuitive ones that we wrote about is practice number 3, empower the people. And we were looking at how foundations and donors can work directly with individuals. You know, not nonprofit leaders, not government leaders, not the elites, but, you know, the grassroots out there. And it's hard. And we started thinking about it, you know, every individual can be a philanthropist, even though they wouldn't call themselves necessarily that, because it sounds like a, you know, it's a $5 word and doesn't feel quite right. But, you know, we thought about the civil rights movement, and we just started playing around with the idea of, you know, if you had to say who was the most significant donor to the civil rights movement that really helped that, you know, move that legislation in the 1960s, create the Voting Rights Acts, and bring so much equality that was lacking in this country until that point. And a lot of times, you know, people might say, oh, it was the Ford Foundation or even the NAACP. But as we started to think about it, you know, it was clear that to get that kind of big change in this country, it wasn't any one foundation. It was the, you know, millions of individuals who sat in at lunch counters and stood up on the back of the bus and marched on Capitol Hill and, you know, advocated and or donated. And so it was the collective effort of obviously millions of individuals that added up to this whole that was greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, but I think the word collective is an extremely important word because there's a new generation of consumer out there, and it's called the net generation. That's that 1970-some-odd to 1996, and it's inclusive. That's a world of people who are using technology the way technology was never used before, and there's no such thing as transparency anymore. So if you want something, you Google it, you do something with it, and you can find out, and I think anybody, whether it's a nonprofit organization, whether it's a business, whether it's research, it's the understanding of that net generation of how they operate, how they think, how they buy. And if you get a handle on that, tied to what you, everything that you just said, I think in the word marketing, whether you're making money or not making money, is still there. You have to market whatever that service is, that idea, that concept, that way of life. You have to market it, but you have to be able to communicate to the people on the other side of your speech. And there's a whole new world out there. And I think 20, 25 years ago, we looked at things differently. The entrepreneurs were different. The philanthropists were different. And today, there's a savvy that you have to have or you won't survive in the world.
Absolutely. And understanding that next generation and tapping into technologies is something that we looked at. I mean, it's become increasingly important for companies. For instance, we're doing a case study right now on a foundation in London, the Thomson Reuters Foundation. And it's a legal publishing company. Thomson acquired Reuters, the news agency, several years ago. And the, you know, it became very clear that the young people coming up in that company, it's really important to them that their company is a good corporate citizen, that they're able to be involved with causes. And that's obviously a trend that's occurring across the entire private sector. And companies are realizing we really have to do more than give. We've got to get involved with causes, and it just can't be paying lip service to these things.
You know, I've got the book in front of me, by the way, and I happen to open it up to page 97, and right in front of me it says define collaboration. And true collaboration requires a commitment to shared goals, jointly developed structure, shared responsibility, mutual authority and accountability for success, et cetera, et cetera. That's really the key to that. That's the social networking. That is how any business, large or small, will be successful today, because there's got to be a collaboration from the top down and from the bottom up. And if there are those shared goals, then everybody is on the same page. If, by chance, there's not necessarily shared goals only because somebody doesn't know what their job is, quote unquote, that's when the problems start. So if the communication is good at the top, your marketing is inside the communication. And collaboration in and of itself is one of the most important things that you can have today, because without it, there's going to be a disconnect, and that disconnect will cause a problem. And in most organizations, it ends up to be the problem at the bottom line. Cost you money. Okay, we're starting to run out of time. Leslie Crutchfield, is there a website we can find you at?
The book website is domorethangivebook.com, and there, if you're interested, you can read about some of the cases and meet some of the donors, and there's a free copy of Chapter 1 that you can download and get a taste of what we're talking about.
Wonderful. Hey, Leslie, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Okay, take care.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oasis. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Keyshawn Durant with us, and he's the author of Escalating Success. Listen to it closely, Escalating Success. And that's a word that most people have a little bit of trouble with. It's 101 ways to move past depression, and I think it's available for release right now. Yeah, as a matter of fact, February, it did come out. Keyshawn has been featured nationally in Canada and TSN. He's appeared on various radio programs, online blogs. He is a life coach, a motivational speaker, pro athlete, mental health advocate, and author again of the book Escalating Success. Keyshawn, hey, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me today.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Let's go back, because your life in and of itself is really what the book is about, and there's so much to learn, so many lessons within what you had to go through to become who you are today. Let's go all the way back. What was life like for you as a teenager?
Well, as a teenager, I was pretty much bigger than the average kid. My first year of teenagehood, I was 13. I was approximately about 6'2", 170 pounds. So you can imagine that's pretty big for a teenager.
Oh, yeah, by the way, you know what you call guys that big?
What do you call them?
Sir.
What do you call them?
Sir.
Uh-huh. Oh, sir. That's funny. That's funny. But yeah, I was a pretty big kid. I mean, I was so big that, during the peewee years, I wasn't able to play peewee football because of the weight restrictions, because I was so big. So ultimately, I couldn't start playing football until I was around 14 years old, which I started playing on JV, which is junior varsity football. And I started there in junior varsity when I was 14 years old. But actually, when I was 13, I played on a national AAU basketball team, which I got a chance to visit the great city of St. Louis and visit the Arc at age 13, which was a pretty big accomplishment for a kid that age. And when I got around 14, I started playing junior varsity football, and I was a quarterback for the junior varsity team. And when I got around 15, that's when I really started, noticing my talents. You know, when I was at the age of 15, I started playing basketball, football, baseball, ran track, and also played soccer. And, I was all-region, all-city, lower state champion in track for 3 years from the 10th to the 12th grade. And I just played a lot of sports coming up as a teenager.
Now, by the way, you did this, and a lot of kids couldn't do what you did. But then somehow depression set in. Where was that? What time frame was that?
Well, actually, the depression started kind of a small bit of after I got out of high school because, like I said, when I was in high school, going into my senior year in high school, I got recruited by pretty much every college in the country. But I was a Proposition 48, which was you actually had to have a 700 on your SAT or you had to have a 2.0 GPA to actually play at a Division I school on a scholarship, which I didn't meet that criteria. So I ultimately had to go to a historically black college, which was South Carolina State University in Orangeburg, South Carolina, but I wasn't able to play my first year. I had to, show the university and show the football team that I was, coming in and to be able to keep my grades up to par. And then going to in my sophomore year, I was able to play. So it really kind of started like after I got out of high school and couldn't play my first year of college ball because, like I said, I was playing sports since I was 12 or 13 years old. And so I ultimately couldn't play my first year. And it kind of like set in, I really didn't know what to do. I couldn't practice and stuff like that. I wasn't even affiliated with the team. But, that ultimately came to a demise when my second year I actually got on the team. And what happened going into my first year, which was actually my second year of college, I had a mild stroke at the age of 19. I had a stroke on the left side of my brain which paralyzed the right side of my face, which is it was called Bell's palsy, which was a mild stroke. So ultimately, it messed up my vision in my right eye. It gave me a real bad astigmatism. And once I had that astigmatism in my eye, me and the coaches, for the university, we couldn't agree to terms, and so I ultimately lost my scholarship. So once that happened to me, I didn't give up, but, during that time, I wasn't playing football for like 1 or 2 years. During that time, I started getting depressed, didn't know what to do, failed to go to classes and stuff like that. But then I ultimately got a chance to play semi-pro football, which was a blessing for me. I felt like I was back in the saddle, and I played for 2 years, and going into my second year, at the last game of the season, I tore my ACL, and after that, my career was over with. And then after that, I really fell into a real, real bad hole of depression after that.
Let's go back just for a moment to that mild stroke. With, you know, there's a lot of people who get a stroke and life's over for the most part for them. If they're an athlete, if they do anything physical, it affects, you know, one part of the body. It's very hard to speak. So the stroke was mild. But what do you think brought the stroke on?
Well, it was due to hypertension. It runs in my family pretty bad. My grandmother, she passed when she was around 53, you know, due to blood pressure problems, and she had heart disease. And my uncle, which was her son, he died at 26 with a massive heart attack. So, and, you know, my mother has hypertension. I have it. And I'm not sure if my brothers have it or not. But, you know, luckily those guys are in good shape now, and they're both playing professional football. So hopefully they don't catch the trend of, you know, having hypertension. But that what ultimately gave me the mild stroke. I had hypertension. And, I mean, you're talking, I was 19, you know, in the best shape of my life, and I had no idea that I had high blood pressure. And that's what ultimately caused me to have that mild stroke.
Now, by the way, when other athletes, you know, obviously you've been around a lot of athletes, you know, and when you did the book, I'm sure you've done research, especially being a life coach. Do you find a lot of athletes run into this problem because the standards are so tough, and what's expected out of you every morning when you get up, are you sure that you're going to do what everybody thinks you can do, and are you going to be quote-unquote good enough for everybody out there? Does that play a role?
Oh, it definitely plays a role in it because, you know, a lot of people don't understand, you know, the life of an athlete, especially when you get on a professional level. I mean, you get up every day, you have a rigorous routine, you work out, you know, you have dietitians and stuff to show you how to eat and to actually, you know, keep yourself in, you know, tip-top shape. And not only that, you have to do that and condition your body to be able to perform every week, you have the pressures of guys trying to take your position. I mean, you know, every day it's a struggle. People are trying to take your position. And not only that, I mean, you have the fans, you know, you have the, you know, the lights and the glamour and, you know, the paparazzi and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, you have to be careful how you do things in society. Not only that, you have to be a, you know, professional on the field, you have to be professional off the field. And, you know, factor in that with, you know, millions and millions of dollars, you know, when you get to the professional level, you know, all that is strenuous on anybody.
Sure.
And I think that's things that are going on with these professional athletes that, you know, the outside community doesn't see, which is very stressful. And then, you know, I think a big problem is, you know, when these guys are professional athletes, they're not trained to figure out and make the transition after their, you know, professional career is over with, you know, concerning, you know, with athletics. And I think that's a big problem. I think something needs to be done and, you know, some type of, I don't care if it's classes, some type of, you know, some type of therapy or something to get these professional athletes ready for the transition after their sports career is over with.
I think when you really dig down into this, and it's hard to see when it's happening, and I'm sure if you look back, it's easier to look back, obviously, than to be going through it at the moment, and it's always going to be part of your life. But what a great gift in and of itself, and you can really look back and say thank you, because look at the lives you get to touch. If none of that would have happened to you, you wouldn't be doing what you do today.
Right. You're absolutely correct. You know, and you know, I really feel like I'm blessed because, you know, I tell my students and, you know, people that I go talk to, and, you know, I stress to them that the best teacher in life is experience. I mean, you really don't understand something until you experience. I mean, if you're a smoker, I can tell you all day that you're going to get cancer by smoking, but you're not going to listen to me until the doctor actually comes to you and says, listen, you have cancer. And, you know, I was just trying to give you an example about it. You know, the best teacher in life is experience, and these guys have to experience that. And I just think that it really is a big problem. It really is a big problem. But thankfully, you know, I'm really blessed to be able to go back to these guys and talk to them and make sure that they understand that they're not going to be able to run those 4.4s anymore, those 4.5s, and, you know, jump high as they used to when they were, you know, young guys. So that ultimately comes to a demise, and you have to figure out some type of game plan or some kind of contingency plan and have a backup so you can, you know, be able to make that transition from professional sports to average, you know, everyday living, which is a hard transition. But, you know, like I said, I deal with it every day, even though, you know, I'm around football, you know, I'm around these kids, and it actually helps me continue dealing with my depression and not being able to play sports anymore by talking to the kids and talking to the, you know, some of the adults that are in college and stuff like that. And it really makes me feel good to be able to go back to talk to these people and actually try to help them, because it really is something that they're going to have to deal with some point in time in their life. And I think that's something that's not being stressed to these athletes.
No, and as a matter of fact, you know, you can be big and strong and powerful and all of that in sports, but there's other ways to be big, strong, and powerful, and even beyond that. And I think that's just something that some of these people have to see. I know I've never been involved in AA, but I've done. Oh my goodness, Kishan, I can't tell you how many interviews over the years. And the one thing that I've learned as an outsider looking in, that the best counselor for a program like that is one who's been there, done that, had to go through the program and got back up on their feet so people could relate to them. And you just said it. Some of these people that you're working with right now, that if you hadn't been there, you hadn't gone through it, you wouldn't be believable.
Sure, sure, sure. And I really think I've been blessed being, you know, doing the things I did athletically, because a lot of people know me for the things that I did on the field. And so when I go back and talk to these people, they're more attentive and saying, well, he really must know what he's talking about because he's been through that. And I mean, you're absolutely 100% correct. So it's real easy for me to be able to get these guys' attention. I just had a speaking engagement at South Carolina University a couple of weeks ago, and the people who set me up for the speaking, they came to me after I talked to the athletes, and they said, we've never seen the football team this attentive. You know, when actual speakers come in to try to speak to them and talk to them, and that made me feel real good, because when I talk to the guys, I put on, I don't know if you saw the little interview I had with TSN, but that's how I always open my speaking engagements, so I can grab their attention and, look, you're not talking to somebody that hasn't been through this. I've been through this, going through it, and still is continuing going through it. So I think, you know, the things that I've done in my life for sports are concerned definitely has its advantage when I go and talk to these kids, because they really do listen, because I've been through it, and I was going through the things that they're going to go through and going through.
Kishan, the book itself, in and of itself, Escalating Success, I pick it up, I read it page by page, cover to cover, and I have it in front of me. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get once I've gone through this, I've read it, and how's my life changed, or what kind of a direction can I take after I've read it? What am I going to get?
Well, I think you're going to get closures. You know, a lot of people don't know, it's over 120 million people worldwide that suffer from depression, and over 20 million here in the U.S. alone. And it's, you know, I stress to people all the time, my book is not just for athletes, it's for everybody, because this type of depression, you know, is common in everyday person. I think you're going to get, people are going to relate, maybe not to the athletic side of it, but relate to something that is going on in their lives, that they may have went through a form of depression. And it tells you how I went from the top to the bottom, back to the top. That's why I call it Escalating Success, because my life has continued past football, because I wasn't just defined by the things that I dealt with on the field. And I think that's what you're going to get from this book. I have other athletes that give their stories about what happened to them and how they went through depression. And I also have some psychologists and their thoughts on how to help professional athletes. But all in all, I think you're going to come away with a strong feeling about yourself, and I give advice, and I give 101 ways naturally to move past depression, because like I said, a lot of people are dealing with depression, and I think this book is universal. It's just not for the athletes. It's just for everybody, and I think it is a tool that people will be able to read and help them through some type of form of depression they may have been through or going through now, and I think that that's what you'll come away from this book.
Now, by the way, I've got the book open. Let me tell you what I love about it. You know, with the remedies, and one of the things that most people do not realize, your brain is an electrochemical factory. And based on the chemical that's released from the brain, it's going to dictate how you feel, good, bad, or indifferent, depressed, happy,
sure,
whatever the case may be. And you've got a lot of pages dedicated to what to take, because those things will offset. You know, you're depressed, maybe you're low on something. And wouldn't it be interesting if you could fix it all by what you eat?
Yeah, it does. A lot of things, it's a lot of different things you eat. I mean, blueberries, grapefruit oil. I mean, just simple things like getting a haircut, because if your hair is, you know, you might need a haircut, you do something simple as getting a haircut, and when you look in the mirror, you'll be like, wow, I look totally different. And that in itself makes the body react, and you release the chemicals that you're talking about to make you feel better about yourself. You know, when you're in stressful situations, do simple things, meditation, running, smiling, you know, I mean, just simple things like that that a lot of people don't know that you may have in your house every day that may help the mood in your body, because like you said, your body is made up of so many chemicals, and when you release these happy chemicals in your body, that can help you through some of your hard times and stressful times, and if you're going through some depression.
You know, there's that old adage that laughter is the best medicine, obviously. But
oh, it is. I really and truly believe it is, because I don't think, regardless of what you go through in your day, may it be stress at work, the kids, you know, car trouble, anything, if you can talk to somebody or watch something on TV that will make you smile and laugh, you will be stress-free for those few minutes. And I really think laughter is the best medicine. I really do. I really think that is the key.
Let me take it a step farther, because what happens when you laugh, your brain releases endorphins. That's the feel-good. That's the calm-you-down chemical. And once that happens, you laugh, you smile, your brain releases, quote-unquote, the happy chemicals, and it takes on you take on a completely different look at things. But there is a dynamic that occurs when you laugh. It's not just laugh and you'll be happy. It's laugh and you change your brain chemistry, which causes you to feel better.
You are absolutely right. You are absolutely 100% correct. You're absolutely correct. And like I said, different types of food does the same thing as laughter. It's just in the book, I have all different types of, you know, fruits and vegetables that you can eat to release those endorphins. And, you know, things that are high in antioxidants, which, you know, release the chemicals and rejuvenate your cells and actually makes the body feel better. It starts rejuvenating and making new skin, and you're starting to glow. And simple things, just like water. I mean, water does the same thing. But a lot of people, like I said, don't know these remedies, but I offer it right here in the book.
Now, by the way, one of the remedy number 7 I absolutely love on page 149. Remedy number 7 is great because it's dog therapy. I've got 3 dogs, and they're both about 100 pounds apiece, but they think they're 6-pound poodles, okay? And if you have a dog, and I like what you've said here, because effectively the dog depends on you, gives you a sense of purpose because they allow you to feel needed. And there are so many people that go through life and never feel needed, and a pet can do that, Kishon.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And athletes go through the same thing because, you know, when you get, I had an interview earlier, and I was telling the host that I was talking to, a lot of people don't understand. You're never going to get that type of feeling far as being a professional athlete. When you go out there and people are calling your name, the lights and stuff like that, I love my wife and my kids to death. You know, being married was one of the biggest things and a big accomplishment in my life. But you're never going to get that feeling again. So we have, as athletes, have to find, you know, ways to fill in that void. And, you know, just like the common man, somebody that's not an athlete, like I said, the dog therapy, you have that companion, you have that friend. And you have, you know, like I said, you want to feel wanted. Everybody wants to feel that. May it be an athlete or somebody that's doing something that, you know, that's not, you know, pertaining to sports. And you're absolutely right.
No question about it. And by the way, what I love about what you've done is very simple. Simple is the word. It's practical. It's not anything that's airy-fairy. It's not anything that you're going to wrap around, you know, going to wrap a rag around your head and sit 5 feet off the ground and meditate. That's not what we're talking about. We are talking about practical, easy-to-use solutions to a problem.
Very easy, very easy, very easy. Like I said, these are some other things that are right in your grocery store, some things that you may have around the house that you had no idea that will help you through your hard times.
No question. And Kishon, let me ask you this. Do you have a website that we can find yet? We're starting to run out of time.
Oh, sure. You can reach me at my website, which is www.kishon, that's K-E-S-H-A-W-N, Durant, Durant.com. You can also find me on Twitter and also on Facebook.
Wonderful. And the book is Escalating Success. And if anybody missed it, if it won't buy too fast, it'll be up on our website. Hey, Kishon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Dresser. You have a good day.
Take care. Good night.
All right. Thank you.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all.
I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand of holding leaves begin to fall, and a loving's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore.
Joe Cipriano with us. He's one of the most recognizable voiceover artists on national television, and he's the guest announcer on Wheel of Fortune, longest-running syndicated game show in U.S. television history with over 5,000 episodes, currently hosted by Pat Sajak and Vanna White. He served as the comedy voice for Fox TV Network promos since 1988, similar positions as a signature voice in CBS, NBC, and as a matter of fact, you'll probably recognize the voice. Joe, welcome to the show.
Wow, that was quite an intro. Thank you there, Michael Ray. I appreciate that.
And thank you so much for being here. How did it all start for you? Where was that point where you have the voice, they wanted to hear it, and you connected with the networks?
Well, you know, I started in radio, hosting, you know, music shows and things like that. Started in Connecticut back when I was a kid. And actually, my first radio station was owned by Merv Griffin. And here we are years later, have this opportunity to be a part of a Merv Griffin creation, Wheel of Fortune. But so radio took me to Washington, D.C. from Connecticut, where I met my wife. We moved out to Los Angeles. We were both broadcast kids. And, you know, I'd always had this interest in getting into being a network voice. I just thought that was so cool, you know, to represent a television network. And, you know, there were guys, Michael, like, you know, Ernie Anderson, The Love Boat, you know, and Danny Dark, the legendary voices of NBC and ABC. And I just happened to come to Los Angeles. You know, you have to have an agent when you do this. I was able to hook up with an agent, started working on movie trailers back in the 80s, like teen movies, like Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I did the trailers for that and commercials and Bachelor Party and Porky's, you know, all those teen movies from the 80s. And,
oh, sure.
Yeah, started to grow a career from there. The big break was I was on the air one day filling in for someone on a radio station in Los Angeles, and this brand-new network called Fox had just come on the air, and the head of marketing and on-air promotion was driving home and heard me on the air and said, now that's an interesting voice. And that was 22 years ago. So that was a pretty cool break.
Yeah, no question about it. One of the things you're doing now, which I think is interesting, is mentoring Ted Williams, the homeless man with the voice. Unbelievable. I remember listening to him talk, and I'm thinking, where did that voice come from? How could you be homeless all that time and have this basic? It's not the talent, it's the voice.
Yeah.
You create the talent from the voice.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's such a, I don't know, a tragic story. It's also a story of hope and redemption. And you know, he was at the top of his game in radio in Columbus, Ohio. And, you know, you start going out to parties and you start believing your own public relations. And he got into drugs. He got into alcohol. I mean, he really hit bottom, crack, cocaine, on the streets, living on the streets for 15 years, but he always had that voice. And he, He was very fortunate in that he's a very intelligent man, and he was able to keep himself alive. And of course, he got into a lot of problems. His story is quite amazing. He's working on a book right now, which is going to be fascinating.
How was it to work with him?
You know what? He's a very affable. He's a funny guy. I mean, he has a great personality. But he's also an addict, and as an addict, that's something that you have for your entire life. He's telling us, the Team Ted, it's myself and Randy Thomas, who's the voice of Entertainment Tonight, and we're kind of mentoring him and trying to bring him into the voiceover community. He really does need to go into rehab, and he is committed to doing that, and I think he needs to do a good 30, 60, 90 days in rehab, because we don't want him, and he doesn't want to be a flash in the pan. There's going to be a lot coming at him. There already was, and it didn't go very well. So he really needs to have that base, and he understands that, and nobody more than himself, he gets it. So, but he is, there's just this comedy that comes out of it, you know, where you might say something about a TV show that you and I know, like everybody knows Raymond. But, you know, he was living on the street. He didn't watch TV. He missed so much of pop culture that happened. And it is somewhat comical every once in a while. Things that you and I would, you know so well, he has no idea what it is.
Oh, absolutely. Let's take it back for a moment, because I got into the business about 1983. And you got one in 88. It was completely different in those days than it is today. How do you find media, because radio and TV is media. How do you find media today as opposed to what it was like when you got into it?
Well, when you're talking about voiceovers, we talk about radio as well. In voiceovers, first of all, back in the day when I first came up, all the voices were men, and all the voices were that big, deep voice, you know, the voice of God type voices. And I always think that the reason for that is, there are many, but one of them is, you know, back in the day, television and radio had very tiny little speakers, and they were kind of tinny sounding. And the only thing that really cut through was that big bass voice that would cut through. And as technology grew and, FM and HD and the audio quality that there is today and there has been for the past 12, 15 years, now there are more real people that are starting to, or have, gotten into voiceovers and radio as well. So you don't have to have that big voice. What's going on now in commercials and in network television, they want the sound or the image of that network or that commercial to mirror America and pop culture. And they want it more to be an every person kind of thing, not necessarily an every guy. And every person, and thank goodness it's taken forever, but women are finally pretty much on a level plane when it comes to voiceovers. And, it took so long for that. You remember, Michael, in radio and in television, you would never see a woman on the air. There were no women DJs back in the 70s and early 80s.
And, yeah, Joe, I remember. The other thing that I think is critically important, and you just said it, let me say it a different way. The networks have to have recognizable voices. They have to have voices now that the audience can relate to. And if the audience relates to the voice, they actually see the pictures that flow from the words. And if they're not relatable, you lose that audience. And part of their marketing to bring people to them is to have people doing the work for them that audiences relate to.
Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head. That's exactly right, and even more so now when we have 700 or more channels out there. There is so much entertainment out there. You have to, if you're on a channel, hopefully, you know, the look of the channel and also the sound of the channel and the voices that represent it, you don't even have to look in the corner to see what network it is. You can tell just by the voices.
Oh, absolutely. And that recognizable is extremely important. Because there is when you listen to the right voice, whatever that is, time and place, you feel the voice, you experience the pictures in your mind of what the voice is saying, And they become kind of that sticking point where you know to trust. When this happens and you hear that voice, you know what you're going to expect for the next half hour to the hour. And I think that's what most people need right now, because we live in such a frightening time with the economy.
Oh, my gosh. You're telling me. I mean, it's just and it's hit all areas. And it's hit television. It's hit radio. It's hit every industry out there.
No, absolutely. There's radio stations that are closing down right now. And I think the biggest problem, it's a reversible cause and effect. I don't want to get off track here, but I think what we're really dealing with is we have media telling the world that you're broke, you don't have anything, and be careful with what you spend, et cetera, et cetera. They talk about the 8 to 10% unemployment. But, you know, Joe, they don't talk about the 85, 90% that are employed. So there's still money out there, and it's scary because, in one hand, the media scares you into not spending money, and then the other hand, we complain because people aren't advertising the way they used to.
You know, I don't understand why that's turned around that way. It used to, broadcasting, TV and radio used to be a very positive sort of atmosphere, and you're right. There's a lot of fear-based reporting that's going on there. It's a very strange phenomenon.
It's entertainment. And when I say entertainment, there is that blur from national media today. There's that blur of the news and entertainment. And whatever they think entertainment is, and I'm sorry to say this, but it's, you know the old adage, if it bleeds, it leads. But it's the death, dying, and destruction. That's all you see constantly. And that's what they think will keep an audience. Now, someday it's going to stop. And they're going to be in trouble with it.
Yeah, I agree completely. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Now, what's in the future for you? What do you see?
Oh, for me? I've been very fortunate. I work at CBS Television Network, and I do the voiceovers for a lot of their comedies there, like Rules of Engagement, 2 and a Half Men, believe it or not, which is still on the air in reruns.
For that job. do you think Sheena will come back?
You know, I don't think it can happen. I think it's impossible. There's been way... talk about burning bridges. Have we ever seen it like this before? I don't think it's going to happen. And I don't know if they're going to even save the franchise, if they're going to recast. That'll be really, really weird. I mean, it's been done before, but if I had to bet on it, I don't think that Charlie Sheen is going to end up back on 2 and a Half Men.
Yeah, but the other side of that, I don't think they can replace Sheen. So I think that it's going to go.
Yeah, his personality is such a big part of that show, and I'm sure they can. You know, there was talk of Rob Lowe. That would be interesting, and John Stamos, and they'd really have to find the right type to fit in there. But it would be very difficult. That's for sure.
And what he's done to himself, recently when he started his tour, he was getting $300 a ticket. Now it's down to $25, $26, and they're giving it away. The people are walking out on him. That in and of itself is going to end up killing him.
Yeah, it will. You know, here's another guy that I hope that he gets healthy. He says he is healthy. I hope he continues. I don't know if he needs to go back into rehab or what it is, but... I don't understand how it got so completely out of control. It's just unbelievable. Right
on
your TV.
Pulled it
screen.
Off was Joaquin Phoenix. I'm sure you saw the interview that he did on television, one of the big talk shows. He was just being strange, and he got strange for a while. And then it just came out that it was just a big joke, and then he's back doing what he's doing. He got away with it. Sheen's too public with this. I don't think he'll get away.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone believes that he's not being serious. I think this is truly, he's being serious. So with the other thing, with Joaquin, it was like, oh, okay, while it was happening, it was like, what the heck is going on? And then you found out later that this was, all a setup, and it was just kind of a joke. I don't think that's the way it is with Charlie.
No, I don't think so at all. And I really believe when it comes down to it, we've got a different kind of talent that was there. I'm going to go back before... The 80s. I want to go back to the 50s when you had the Doris Day types and the rest of it. When the rule of the road, if there was a bedroom scene, Joe, 1 foot had to be on the floor.
That's right.
And those were the, you know, those were the days. It was a completely different world. And the biggest concern is that, you know, the movies, radio, TV, we set the patterns for what goes on out there. And anybody can say anything that they want to do, but most of what people do are modeled by what goes on and what they hear on radio and television. And and TV is always going to be around. And no matter what it is, it's still considered entertainment.
Exactly. And many times, like you said, a trendsetter as well. And, you know, I was thinking, remember the old Dick Van Dyke show when Rob and Laura had separate beds, too, in the in the bedroom? Yeah.
Yeah, but that was the old days. There were laws that you couldn't, you just couldn't and wouldn't. Now, I'm not a moralist. I never have been and never will be. But I'm a pragmatist. You know, there comes that point where whatever we do in the industry is going to set the pattern for the kids, because I think there's a confusion between what's real and what isn't real. And if you take a look at some of the video games that they're playing now, you know, the carjacking and the kill the cops and the rest of it,
We
wonder what's going on, then it's our own fault by allowing these things to happen. And I think that you and I and everybody else in radio and television have a tremendous responsibility, and that responsibility is to keep some semblance of morality going. And that does not come from a religious point of view. That comes from an American point of view and a traditional point of view.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess it's a matter of setting an example, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And information is great to have, but if you do it ideologically, not you in the general sense of the word, if you do it ideologically, then all of a sudden you're going to hear people who connect with that, and you got problems. And I really believe what's going on today in this world, very quickly, we are the most powerful force in this world. Toe-to-toe, no one could stand up against us. You want to get to us, what you do is you divide us. What you do is we implode internally. And that's what's going on today. And part of what helps it is the media.
Yeah. It's true. It's a sad true fact, but yes.
Okay, by the way, is there a website we can reach you at?
Sure. You can go to joecipriano.com. And Cipriano, by the way, is spelled with a C. So many people think it's spelled with an S. And actually, if you happen to watch Wheel of Fortune this evening, or if you've seen it all this week, I've done 2 weeks of Wheel of Fortune, and you happen to like what I'm doing, the producers of Wheel are putting a huge emphasis on viewer reaction. So if your listeners happen to have seen the show, they could go to wheeloffortune.com/feedback and leave a little message there and say, hey, I heard Joe on with Michael on Dresser After Dark, and I like what he's doing. You know, you never know. You might grab the gig.
By the way, do you do any voice coaching, things of that nature that somebody could take advantage of?
Well, I don't. I will give back. I don't charge people for voice coaching. There are people that are really skilled in that way. But what I have done in the past year, I am the co-founder of the Don LaFontaine Voiceover Lab. Don LaFontaine was the legendary voice of trailers, thousands and thousands of trailers. He passed away 2 years ago, and one of his good friends, Paul Pape, and I, and Don's personal engineer, George Whittam. We brought the entire voice community together to build this lab, and they are working recording studios at the Screen Actors Guild in Los Angeles, and all of the programs there for all of the talent in LA that are in AFTRA and SAG, completely free, seminars, workshops, you can book time in the studio, we have all sorts of coaching possibilities there. We're trying to make it the center of the voiceover community. So that's something that your listeners could find at sagfoundation.org, and that is the Don LaFontaine Voiceover Lab, and we're quite proud of that.
Wonderful. Hey, Joe Cipriano, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michael. I really appreciate it. Have a great night, and thanks to your listeners.
Great. Good night.
Night, everybody.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Oh, and there we go. I wonder if our guest is up. Can I see it? Okay, I can't see into the ethers. Maybe the angel from the network could call the guest. I wonder if my voice... We never liked the guest anyway. Okay, not a problem. All right, let's just move with whatever we have. I'm Michael. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. One of the things I got asked to do is I told a story about a teacher. I guess it was about... Oh, a week or so ago. And I got a request to do it again because it's such a powerful story. And when I really take a look at what you're dealing with in the world today, there's so many people who define things, but they don't define them in such a way that it's understandable to people. And the story about the teacher was one of those very special stories. As a matter of fact, it was so special that it's about growing up. And it's about growing up when you're an adult. And you don't have to be a kid to grow up. And I imagine out there that we have all grown up some, and you could be 60, 70 years old, and all of a sudden something happens in your life, and you say, well, I think it's time to grow up. You see things differently. And as a matter of fact, when people do see things differently, looking at things in a way that you didn't think about looking at them before, the world seems to change. It's almost like this. Use this as an example. You know, we're standing in a room together. And you're standing there, your legs are together, your ankles are together, your hands are at your sides, and you're just as stiff as you possibly can be. You're stiff as you possibly can be. And I push you forward and with a certain amount of pressure, and you're going to fall back. But what if you kind of relaxed your legs, you moved your feet apart, you got to a place where you had your balance, and in that balance, you kind of felt strong, and I pushed you with the same amount of pressure. Guess what? You're not going to fall down. So what's the message here? The message here is very simple. The message is that all you have to do is shift in your position, and the same exact thing can happen, and guess what? It's all completely different. Now, the teacher's name was Mrs. Thompson, and she stood in front of her fifth grade class on the very first day of school, and she told the children a lie. And like most teachers, she looked at her students and said that she loved them all exactly the same. But this was, for her, impossible, because there in the front row, slumped in his seat, was a little boy by the name of Teddy Stoddard. Mrs. Thompson had watched Teddy the year before and noticed that he didn't play well with the other kids. His clothes were messy, and he constantly needed a bath. And Teddy could be very unpleasant. Well, it got to the point where Mrs. Thompson would actually take delight and marking his papers with a broad pen, making bold X's on them, and then putting a big F right at the top of the papers. Now, at the school where Mrs. Thompson taught, she was required to review each child's past records, and she put Teddy's off until obviously the very last. It was him. However, when she reviewed his file, she was in for a pretty big surprise. You see, Teddy's first grade teacher wrote, "Well, Teddy's bright. He's a bright child. He's got a ready laugh. He does his work neatly, and he's got very good manners. And actually, he's a joy to be around." And then she read a little deeper, and she found that his second grade teacher wrote, "Teddy is an excellent student, well-liked by his classmates, but he's troubled because his mother has a terminal illness, and life at home has got to be a struggle. And then she went even deeper than that. The third grade teacher wrote, his mother's death has been hard on him. He tries to do his best, but his father just doesn't show him much interest, and his home life isn't there, and it soon affected him in different ways. And if they weren't very careful, if steps weren't taken, he could be very affected. Teddy's fourth grade teacher wrote, Teddy's withdrawn, doesn't show much interest in school, doesn't have many friends, and he sometimes sleeps in class. Now, by now, Mrs. Thompson realized the problem, and she was ashamed of herself. And she felt even worse when her students brought her Christmas presents wrapped in beautiful ribbons and bright paper, except for Teddy's. His present was clumsily wrapped in a very heavy brown paper bag that he got from the grocery store. Mrs. Thompson took pains to open up the in the middle of the other presents, his presents. And some of the children started to laugh when she found a rhinestone bracelet with some of the stones missing, and a bottle that was one quarter full of perfume. And she stifled the children's laughter when she exclaimed how pretty the bracelet was. Putting it on and dabbing some of the perfume on her wrist, Teddy Stoddard stayed after school that day just long enough to say, Mrs. Thompson, today you smell just like my mom used to. And after the children left, she cried for at least an hour. And on that very day, she quit teaching.
Our guest is with us.
She kept reading. She kept writing arithmetic. Instead, she began to teach children. And Mrs. Thompson said, and she said that she was going to pay particular attention to Teddy. And as she worked with him, his mind seemed to come alive. And the more she encouraged him, the faster he responded. And by the end of the year, Teddy had become one of the smartest children in that class. Despite her lie that she would love all the children the same, Teddy became her teacher's pet. And a year later, she found a note under her door from Teddy, telling her that she was the best teacher he'd ever had in his whole life. And 6 years went by before she got another note from Teddy. He then wrote that he finished high school, third in his class, and she was still the best teacher that he ever had in his whole life. 4 years went by. She got another letter saying that while things had been tough at times, she stayed in school and stuck it out. And he would soon graduate from college with the highest of honors. And he assured Mrs. Thompson that she was still the best and the favorite teacher that he ever had in his whole life. Then another 4 years passed by, and another letter came. This time he explained to her that he got his bachelor's degree, and he decided to go a little further. The letter explained that she was one of the best of the favorite teachers that he ever had still. But now his name was a little longer. See, the letter was signed Theodore F. Stoddard, M.D. Now, the story doesn't stop there. You see, there was yet another letter that spring. Teddy said he met this girl and was going to be married, and he explained that his father had died a couple of years ago, and he was wondering if Mrs. Thompson might agree to sit in the place at the wedding that was usually reserved for the mother of the groom. And, of course, Mrs. Thompson said yes. Guess what? She wore the bracelet, the one with several rhinestones missing. And then she made sure that she was wearing the perfume that Teddy remembered his mother wearing on their last Christmas together. And they hugged each other. And Dr. Stoddard whispered in Mrs. Thompson's ear, thank you, Mrs. Thompson. Thank you for believing me. Thank you so much for making me feel important and showing me that I can make a difference. And Mrs. Thompson, with tears in her eyes, whispered back. She said, Teddy, you have it all wrong. You were the one who taught me that I can make a difference. And I don't know, I didn't know how to teach until I met you. So go out and warm somebody's heart today. Pass it along. And then remember, wherever you go, whatever you do, you have the opportunity to touch or change a person's outlook. And it can be within the smallest thing, and you will never know exactly why or how it happened. Oh, it's time for that segment of some good minutes with Dr. Eisenstein. Hey, Mayor, how are you?
Oh, Michael, that was such a warm story. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. You know, it reminds so much. You know, my wife Karen's a teacher, and she taught third grade, and she would get enormous amount of letters, you know, years later after she stopped teaching from some of her students because she taught in the inner city. And the students of third grade couldn't read at all. And so she had to bring comic books to class, and she brought comic books. and taught them to read from comic books. And many of them later became lawyers and doctors and said, you know, we remember when you brought comic books to class for us to read. You know, that's fabulous.
Yeah, and it's just that something special that somebody does, and all of a sudden you're looking at a life that is totally touched and totally changed.
There's no question about it. Well, I might know. I am in sunny Florida. I've been here for the last week. I spoke last weekend at the American Academy of Anti-Aging Physicians. You know, of course, you know, I was speaking about what else? Metabolic syndrome and HCG. And there are more than 1,000 doctors that came and attended the seminar that I gave. All of them interested in doing this. And many of them I knew 4 or 5 years ago and hadn't seen me in 3 or 4 years, you know, and were just blown away by this whole phenomenon, in a sense. I mean, that's the, and it was just really incredible. So I ended up staying here because there were doctors throughout the state of Florida were attending, and I've been visiting their offices one by one, helping them start HCG and metabolic clinics. It's been very exciting.
Now, by the way, what's it like when you look in the mirror today?
You know, I don't recognize the person, to tell you the honest truth, but then I look and I say, I myself have never been one to care one way or the other how I looked, in a sense. I that's a funny way to put it. You know, I actually most probably just forgot about it for a long time because, you know, I tell you what, I give praise to God, you know, that I really, you know, and especially with Passover coming, what a great time to think of redemption, I just feel so blessed that at my age of 65, to have found something, you know, when most people are kind of slowing down, like yourself, we're speeding up. I mean, we're not, every day that we're given is a blessing, you know. And to be able to do something uniquely different, and I just got to relate to you the story I have, my medical case of a gentleman who I met out in California when I was there a few weeks ago. I just heard from this week. Tennis pro. He was in his early 60s. He was semi-bedridden. You know, he's about 100 pounds overweight. And he was actually on the professional tour, you know, 30 years ago. And he taught tennis up until about 10 or 15 years ago. And he kept putting on weight. He's lost about 30 pounds. But it's more than 30 pounds because he's still significantly overweight. He's back teaching. He's on the court for the first time in 10 years. I mean, you know, and he said, thank you. I can't believe this, you know, because it's very fascinating. It seems that the HCG is more than just AIDS and weight loss. There's been studies now linking it to pain management. There was a group at, I think it's the University of Tennessee, who in a pain management clinic were giving low doses of HCG, similar to what you would if you were using it to lose weight. And they found within 6 weeks, they had 12 people in one study, 11 of them were able to reduce their pain medication by 40%. How crazy is that?
No, let's go all the way back to the beginning and let's lay a base. Now, you've lost 80-some-odd. How much have you lost so far in weight?
115 pounds.
That's what I meant, 115. But that's that's an entire person.
I know. You're not kidding. It's, you know, and I can tell you something just along with the pain, because I tell you why this is. I weighed about, well, that's as much as I know, because I didn't weigh myself for so many years. And the first time I weighed myself, I was back at the gym trying to lose weight and starving myself. My wife thinks I was actually 340 or 350, you know, but 334 is enough. I had back pain for years, Michael. I mean, years. And I had some supplements that really helped and made a difference, but never really got rid of it. After I lost 30 pounds in the first month of the HCG, I was down to about 300 pounds. And I had no back pain. I assumed it was the 30 pounds that I lost that made the difference. But when I thought about it now, as I heard, so I started reading some of the studies about the pain management, that wasn't enough weight, because I had back pain 30 years ago when I weighed 230 pounds, you know what I mean? Which means it must have been the HCG, which also, along with the weight loss, but the people in the pain clinic, they were not using it all for weight loss. It was strictly for pain management. And so this becomes something just incredible.
And now, by the way, HCG is what?
It's human chorionic gonadotropin. What it is, it's made by women during pregnancy, you know, in huge amounts, like 1 million units a day. And it's labeled a hormone if you look at it, but it's really not a hormone. It's a pre-hormone. It regulates hormones. So in men, it'll actually regulate testosterone, raise testosterone levels, and it also will lower estrogen levels. And estrogen levels are one of the big problems why so many of it has gotten heavy. They feed the cows estrogen, they feed the chickens estrogen, and so all of us are overloaded with estrogen, both male and female. So that's one of the effects it has. You know, by raising testosterone levels, it causes estrogen levels to drop, and that's exactly what we need, because that's the estrogen is stored in the belly fat, and the fat actually makes more estrogen. You know, it's kind of a, we think of fat as this amorphous tissue, but it's not. It's actually an active tissue, which is actually able to make different hormones.
Okay, now is that something that you can buy over the counter pharmacy? Do you have to have a prescription for it?
No, you can't buy it. It's a prescription pharmaceutical. You know, I mean, on the internet you'll find homeopathic versions of it, which people have claimed have helped. You know, but it's questionable as such. You know, it just doesn't seem to follow the laws of homeopathy, which I'm not massively familiar, but many homeopaths have told me that. But it's by prescription. It's available in multiple forms by prescription, by injection, which I do not do, in a cream, which I don't do. But it's also in drops, you know, and comes in a powder, and you reconstitute it with fluid, with sterile fluid, and you put a couple drops under your tongue twice a day. That's why it's mixed up with the homeopathic, which is also drops. But the difference is this has real HCG in it. The homeopathic has no HCG in it.
Okay, how do we fix this problem? Let's say hypothetically that I was 50, 100 pounds overweight, and I'm in Southern California, and you're in Chicago.
Southern California, that's easy. I have two doctors that I know of. Well, it depends. We're in Southern California. You know, we right now have about 50 doctors who are working with us. So anyone's looking for a doctor there, it's still small. It's a big country. There's 300 million people in this country. But it's a growing number of doctors that are involved with this, you know. And I can tell you that if you're 50 miles or so away from a doctor, it's not there, it's worth it. It's worth the effort because, you know, it's not many visits. You know, we recommend highly visits every 2 weeks for 2 months, and then it's every 2 months. And the initial visit is to learn the whole program. And I've got lots of information on our website, homefirst.com. Actually, we have a new website where you can get more. It's homefirst.com/HCG. And our old one will link to the new one there. But we've got lots more information on that on the whole program.
Okay, so effectively, somebody could be anywhere in the country. If they found everything on the web and they went to their own doctor, and the doctor, if they asked the doctor if they could have a prescription for it, then they could do it that way also.
They could do it that, but one of the problems is that you really want a doctor who's well versed in it, who can spend. We spend about 2 hours on the educational program, and we usually have 3 to 5 people at a time. We do blood work to look at the metabolic values. That's done separately, and exams done separately. We also do body composition, because one of the incredible things about this program is you're going to lose about 60% of what you lose will be fat. And that's, and being an athlete yourself, you know that body composition is kind of important, because, you know, if you lose lots of weight and most of it is muscle, well, you haven't done yourself a lot of good, you know. And so that's one of the differentiations of this program. It seems to be that the HCG liberates the fat. It's doing something, because as we measure people's fat, if people have lost 10 pounds, 20 pounds, it'll be 60 and sometimes even as much as 70% fat that they're losing, and mainly in their neck and their abdomen and their thighs. It's unbelievable.
Well,
it's really,
Mayor, let me hold you up, because I don't want to miss this particular point. Okay, so I have somebody in the family, and I won't mention my sister's name, so you have no idea who I'm talking about.
Okay,
because Paula would kill me if she knew I talked to you and mentioned her name. So I'm not going to tell you who it is, okay?
Don't know who it is.
Okay, all right. Now, all right, let me ask you. Okay, so she's losing weight, and she's lost probably 90 pounds so far. All right, say it again.
That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Okay, now, by the way, within a week or so, where there's a little bit of a delay here, sometimes we stumble on each other, but they're going to fix that with a brand new line at the network. But anyhow, and she has got she's worried about something that a lot of women are worried about. And I asked her the other night, I said, well, how much weight you want to lose? She said, I want to get down to X. And I said, gee, you really should be down 20, 30 pounds lower than that. And she said, yeah, but if I do, you know, the neck and all the extra skin and the hanging skin, how do you get rid of that? And I know that's a concern for a lot of people. There are people who could get down to 115, 20 pounds and their weight is perfect at that, but they're going to keep that other 30, 40 pounds on because they're afraid that there's going to have too much hanging skin.
That's extremely good. Well, I could tell you that for whatever reason, this is remarkable because, like, I've lost 115 pounds, and my neck went from a 22 to a 16 and a half. I have nothing. I have nothing in my neck. I don't. You know. In fact, I've got a problem because my waist was 62, and now it's a 40. A 16 and a half neck requires a 36 inch waist. So I have trouble buying shirts. So I have to buy a 17 and a half. You know, because the 16 and a half and the 17 and a half doesn't fit in the neck. It will. God willing, it will. I mean, you know, I'll. This is one of the incredible things about the HCG program. You know, you lose pounds and inches, and the amount of extra hanging skin is minuscule. Minuscule. You know, I've got some obviously in my abdomen, but it's nothing compared. 115 pounds means your skin should be hanging halfway down to your knees. You know, And especially nothing in the face because it doesn't attack the collagen. Collagen is the muscle that that keeps the structural integrity of your face like, and the face is really the most critical in a sense from an aesthetic standpoint. The face, the neck, the shoulder blades, you know, because that's what's visible usually, and you can look at someone who's lost 100 pounds on some other program, and they're far and few between. That's why I commend your sister because that's incredible. Be it gastric bypass, be it lap band surgery, be it Jenny Craig Weight Watchers, they will have faces that look 10 and 15 years older. The people on HCG look 10 or 15 years younger.
Oh, good point. Maybe we're only an hour or so away from you. Maybe she'll drive into Chicago.
Oh, I'd be honored and thrilled. You know, I mean, and she's done a great start. I've had lots of people who come to me with 150 pounds to lose. They come to me having lost 40 or 50 pounds. They kind of get stuck. And I said, you've done a great start. And I have one woman who's now lost 120 pounds. She weighs right now about 120. And she's about 5'3", and she looks ultra spectacular. And I have the special club that I talk about, our 100-pound club, and I didn't think she was part of the club because she only lost on from us 80 pounds. She says, Dr. Isaac, you forgot I lost 40 pounds before I saw you in the last month or two, and she brought pictures. No one would have believed that was pictures of her. You know, I mean, and I've known her for a long time. I've delivered 4 or 5 of her children, but I knew her looking the way she looks now all the time, not the way the pictures she showed me before.
Oh, and all the fun stuff. Now, I know I'm in trouble because I was over in this tax place about a week ago, and something got mentioned about weight, and I said, well, I have a fan club. It's the I Hate Michael Ray fan club, and you know I can eat a meal and have 5 desserts and lose a half a pound. And I swear to you, there were moans coming out of every one of those cubicles.
I let me tell you something. I do believe you with that, but I can tell you something. Just to let you know, Michael Ray is a liar. And I'll tell you why he's a liar. Because I guarantee you if I questioned him that, yes, he can eat anything he wants, as much as he wants, but he doesn't do it all the time.
That's
what makes you. I had a couple I saw today in Tampa. I was helping a doctor in Tampa, and the wife was about 90 pounds overweight. The husband was 10 pounds underweight, you know. And God bless him, he serves in Afghanistan. You know, he's just really a lovely, lovely young man. And he said also he eats all the time. Well, after a little bit more questioning, he said, his wife said, yeah, when he's hungry, but he's not always hungry. And he's, you know, and so it's not a question of metabolism. Some people are blessed, like yourself, in that sense, that they don't, their body knows how to regulate itself. And he told me he's weighed the same weight since he's 15 years old, which is, you know, something is messed up 85% of the country. Because
there was a time that I was 185, 90 pounds, but that 185, 90 pounds was all muscle. I was working out like you wouldn't believe. My arms in those days were 18 inches. And and that was great. And then I started, you know, then I dropped it. And then I became the little weak person that I am, that they kick sand in my face at the beach.
And I'm going to give a bunch of little tips. You know, does Mayer like sports shakes, sports drinks, juice? No. None of that's real. And that's part of the program. You want real. Real means you eat an apple. You eat grapefruit. You don't eat apple juice or grape juice. It's not those are bad foods, but you lose a good part of the nutritional value of the pulp that goes along with that. And, you know, it's just simple little things, you know, and that really make a difference that we all knew, but all of a sudden it became so obvious. So when I leave the house in the morning, Michael, I take two or three apples and put them in the car, so I get hungry and get stuck somewhere. I just eat my apple, you know, and it's the easiest thing to do, and it's more satisfying, and it takes a longer time to eat than buying a candy bar or a sports drink or a sports shake, you know, and then I'll usually buy a bottle of water with it.
Yeah, that's the good stuff. My favorite drink all day long is my whey protein with half and half, two raw eggs, and some olive oil, and I'm a happy camper.
And let me say, and that's needed for people who need to try to keep their weight up.
Yeah.
Remember, that's what all the sports drinks were. They were stuff to keep your weight up, not to lose weight. You know, that's what they were meant for, the healthy powdered shakes. You know, it was, and then they found that they thought maybe they could, it was much easier to market it to people to lose weight, but it never really worked. That's the bottom line.
Mayer, I got to a place which is interesting that I would love, and I've yet to see it, somebody do a show on how to gain weight. Everybody's losing weight, losing weight, losing weight, and there are people out here that need to gain weight.
Yeah, it's about 2% of the population, you know. And for those people, exactly what you described, a whey powder protein with raw eggs and with olive oil, that's exactly what you want to try to gain weight. It's not meant to lose weight. Healthy, really healthy, but to gain weight.
Yeah. No, I got it loud and clear. And the key is I've got 10 more pounds to go, and I'll be a happy camper, and I'll be back where I was before I lost all the weight.
Well, you know, it's very kind of interesting because, you know, I'm struggling now to get under 200 pounds. And I called a couple of sports doctors, and they said, Mayer, you got to start working out in the gym and put on weight.
Yeah.
Because you need to put on about 10 pounds more of muscle, and then you can go back to your program, which will then take off more fat, you know. You know, it's very interesting. I'm nervous to do it, Michael, because, you know, I'm nervous to even put on an ounce. You know, I've been so careful.
But it's a different kind of a weight. I mean, okay, now
different
you're
kind of weight.
You're in my ballpark here. Okay. It's a different kind of a weight.
I'm not that too thin. I still have 30 pounds to go, but my body still doesn't understand it again. So I'm studying this even for the people who've lost lots of weight and get stuck and still need to lose 30, 40 pounds. We're going to figure out how to do it.
Yeah. And by the way, when it all comes down, I think it's going to be great. Then you and I have to celebrate. You lose it, I'll gain it.
I will come to Milwaukee and hand it over.
I got it. If you got an extra 10 or 15 pounds, I will take it anytime. Website, Mayer, we can find you at.
It's homefirst.com. But even better, homefirst.com/HCG. It's not linked together yet. So it's homefirst.com or homefirst.com/HCG.
Wonderful. Hey, we'll see you next week. I'm going to wait right here for you.
Next week. Thank you. Be well.
Okay, you too. Good night.
Good night.
Well, I stepped out the tub, I put my feet on the floor. I wrapped the towel around me and I opened the door. And then a splish splash, I jumped back in the bath. Well, how was I to know there was a party going on? There was a splishing and a splashing.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And do we have a guest?
I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug. Flip flop, they were doing the bop. All the tunes had the dancing bug. There was Lollipop with a Peggy Sue getting golly. Miss Molly was even there too. Well, a splish splash, forgot about the bath. I went and put my dancing shoes on. I was a splishing and a splashing. I was
I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Now let's talk to the angel that floats around the control room. Seth, the guardian angel. Is there a guest?
Pardon me?
Oh, there we go. That's okay, Nova. I didn't realize you were there yet. I would have came on a lot faster. Let me introduce you because I've been waiting for this one. I think it's going to be a great interview. Nova Wallace is with us. That's the pen name of an author who became a mother at 15, graduated from college at age 28, and her first book is finally Unrestricted. Nova, welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you?
Oh, I am fine. How long have you been waiting there?
No, just like a couple seconds, not that long.
Oh, good. Good. Okay. You know, the name of the book in and of itself, Finally Unrestricted, how many people run through life, Nova, with, I'm going to talk about chains around them. They're just, they've got this they've got to put up with, that they've got to put up with, and everybody is expecting and demanding, and they never get that feeling of unrestricted. Where was it for you? How did you come out of it?
You know, I think that most people go through life not following what it is that they feel like they need to be following. And that's rich people and that's poor people alike. You know, people, most people don't pursue their dreams. For me, it really was graduation. It was after I had did the show. It was after I had gone through everything that, you know, I thought I would really be broken as a person, and to know that I wasn't, and to know that I still was graduating. And, you know, when it was all over, you know, I looked back and I was like, I'm finally something. What is it? And I was like, you know, I'm unrestricted. You know, I felt big as a person. And For me, it was accomplishing that. You know, I had my son at 16, and I really didn't think that I would be much in life. You know, I didn't have that support system as far as encouraging me, and everybody was like, "Oh, you know, you're going to be nothing but on welfare, and you're not going to make it." And that's just what everybody really felt about me. And I never thought that I would have the opportunity to go off to college and to do it and graduate. I was like, you know, I made it. I'm unrestricted. You know, whatever happens to me in life, I did that.
And now it's you and not everybody pulling the strings, quote unquote. You know, what a great story, and what a great story it is for young women today. And to really sit down and think about the consequence of having babies as teenagers. There's a part of your life that you don't get anymore, and it stops some of the growing up.
Oh yeah. You know, it does. You know, because I don't want to be a person who says, "Oh, you can make it even if you have a child young," because I know the truth about that. Most people don't.
Sure.
And even with me, accomplishing what I've accomplished, it was so much more in my life that I didn't get to do. But what I will tell anyone is you shouldn't let anything hold you back. You shouldn't stop your dreams. You know, when I first got pregnant with my son, I was only a couple of months, and, you know, word had got out at school, and, you know, everyone was talking about it. And, you know, it was the big talk of the school. And I had a teacher approach me, and she said, "Look, DeBoer, you know, you can do it. You can make it. Just whatever you want to do in your life, do it with your son." And I never forgot that. You know, I went on ahead, and I graduated from high school on time with my class. It was really hard, but I did it. And I took her advice to me even with college. I brought my son with me. So my advice to all the single mothers out there, you know, young and old, because it's a struggle regardless of your age, is, you know, don't focus on the fact that you're a single mom. Focus on the fact that you're still a person with goals. And don't look at your children as a hindrance. You know, that's your family. So you can still accomplish it, you know, just accomplish it around your children. Do it with your children. Try to involve your children. There were times when I was in college that I had to bring my son on campus with me. I had to take him to class with me. You know, he got to go through that experience with me. And looking back, I'm really happy. I'm like, hey, I'm glad I didn't leave him behind. So you can
absolutely
still do it.
Let me ask this, and I think it's an important question. Going through what you went through, and we'll get into the situation you had with your younger brother, but it got you to take a different look at about a different look of the way family interacts, didn't it?
Oh yeah.
There's a message in that, isn't there?
There is. You know, I want to say this because, you know, I still have a difficult relationship with my brother and my family in general. You know, it wasn't all glossy and woo-hoo, I was on national television suing him. It was not a situation like that. It forced me to look at them as people and not as the title that they held in my life. You know, I stopped looking at my brother as my brother and just another person out in the street, and I judged him on that. And that was heartbreaking for me. You know, it forced me to come to the choice in my life that I was going to have to move on without them.
No, but you actually sued him on national television.
Yes, I did. He trashed my condo. We had a good relationship before I left and went off to Western. You know, he basically lived with me. And, you know, we were friends. And I leave and go off to college. He needs a place to stay. I had a condo for rent. I couldn't find a renter. I couldn't find a buyer. So it was a win-win situation for the both of us for him to move in. He moves in. He has his two roommates. Within a couple of months, I start to get violations from the association. Next thing I know, I end up with a bill, final bill, over $10,000. He doesn't care. He's not trying to fight the charges with me. He trashes my condo when he moves out and steals money from me. So, yes, I sued him on national television. I know that's controversial to a lot of people because I've had some people who are like, you should not have sued him regardless, that's your brother. And I get that. But like I said before, I stopped looking at him like my brother and was just like, this is business. If this was anybody else, I would sue them. He doesn't have money. So the show was the only way that I felt I could collect anything from him. I didn't want to put a garnishment on him for the entire $10,000. I had a lawyer in Lansing who that's what she wanted me to do, but I'm like, you know, he'll be paying me forever trying to get that money, and then it will be a situation where he wouldn't keep a job and then would blame me for it. Like, well, I can't get a job because DeVore takes all my money. Nova takes all my money. So that's why I did this show. I had a friend advise me, like, well, hey, if you go on national, one of those court television shows, the show will pay you your settlement. So then I did it on national television. It intensified our situation. For me, it was the fact that he really didn't care at all about what he did for me. He really was looking at the show as a way to jumpstart a television career. That was despicable in my eyes.
I think when it really comes down to it, when there's a will, there's a way. When you have somebody come into your house, disrespect your house, disrespect your way of life, quote unquote, after everything you got went through to be able to let it all go, to become unrestricted, then it was probably a lesson in it for him. Now, maybe he won't learn it today, But if you think about it down the road, he might even end up turning around. We're starting to run out of time. Nova, is there a website that we can find you at?
Yes, you can find my my book on any of the online websites, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. You can also buy it directly from my publisher, iUniverse, at www.iUniverse.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Nova Wallace, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated it. And there should be some lessons in that for people who listen and watch to know that if you struggle for life and you finally get what you want, there's nobody out there that's going to take it away from you.
That is correct. And I hope that everyone out there gets a chance to follow at least one of their dreams.
I hear you. Hey, by the way, thanks for being with us.
And thank you. You have a good night.
Take care. Good night.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jay Gorson with us. He is the author of Relational Triumph, Solving Relational Stress and Building Relational Success. He's been a therapist now in private practice for over 20 years. He's the director, owner of Riverbend Counseling Group, founder of the Harbor Fellowship, Inc., columnist for Christian Week, and author of Triumph, Solving Relational Stress and Building Relational Success. Jerry, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Did I pronounce your last name right?
Yes, Jerry Gertzen. You got it perfect.
Gertzen. Okay, good. I wanted to make sure I had that right. Jerry, thank you so much. Yeah, in putting the book together, relational, and relational is a very interesting word. What does that mean as regards to building, moving through stress, moving through success? Relational is what?
It's the connection. It's the interaction between two or more people. And I think we're all built for that. We've all got it in us to want to have a relationship, and stress is inevitable. So I figured the two of those is a good combination to write about.
Well, by the way, I think it's a great name, and I think it's to lay a base of definition so we get on the same page right from the beginning. Because I really believe in this world today where it's so confusing, and I'm going to take you back to 50, 60 years ago when I was a little kid, and maybe longer than that, 50, 60 years ago when I was a little kid, I think of walking into the house then, and using a four-letter expletive in front of my mother would have been disaster. And she was a little thing, and I was a scrappy kid. The world is different today. The culture is different today. And because of that culture, I think there's a lot of confused people out there that don't have focus. They don't have parameters to live within. And because of that, you've got to be very busy.
That's true. There's no shortage of work on my side of the fence, for sure. But, you know, the joy of it, I love being able to see relationships come together. And sometimes it's a simple matter of not having the right tools or not having awareness of the tools that a person has in their tool belt. And so therapy is actually an incredible privilege. It's a sacred journey to take with people. And if somebody can pick up a few tools and it transforms their relationship, I'm all for it, you know. And I think you're right. I think the culture is so different these days. People are looking for quick gratification. They want results fast. And we're kind of primed for that. And so I think that increases the stress, and I think that increases people's stress reaction. And that's what I talk about in my book is learning to become aware of how it is we respond to one another and what is my part in that reaction, and is my part helpful or is it more harmful?
Jerry, we live in a rewards-based culture. You know, you go all the way back, and your mom or dad would say, clean up your room, and we'll take it to the show tonight. If you want this, we'll give you some. If you do this, we'll give you some candy. And if you want somebody to do something for you, you give them something. And we have gotten to a point that is so overblown, and we're stressed because we don't feel like we're rewarded for who we are. And I think one of the most important things is somebody like yourself who deals with this, deals with it on a daily basis. I wonder how many divorces would not happen if people were trained how to be married.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a bit of a theory on that. I think 80% of the divorces that do happen aren't necessary. I mean, short of some smoking gun issues, you know, when it comes to infidelity or significant abuse, I mean, I get that. But a lot of people disband their marriage and their family for that very reason. And I love being able to help provide them with some mechanisms that they can use to try on and see if it doesn't smooth out the waters and see if it doesn't help them resolve the problems that go unresolved.
See, we're taught so many things in life, but just because, you know, you're a man or you're a woman doesn't mean that you know how to be in a relationship. It doesn't mean that you know how to interact with each other. And, you know, if I repeat this 1,000 times a week, I don't think I can repeat it enough. You always need someone that can look over your shoulder and see what you don't see and bring that invisible up to the table, because there can be, and I'm sure you run into it all the time, people in a relationship, they're having a problem and they're not looking deep enough into it to realize what it is the real problem is. They're working on the wrong problem, and you said it, the divorce in many cases isn't necessary, and they get divorced, and they shouldn't have happened in the first place.
Yeah. Well, you know, Michael, without self-awareness, I don't believe it's possible to change much because we don't know what to work on. And so you're right. We've got to learn to become acquainted with our blind spots. And how do we do that unless we're willing to take a look and willing to receive some objective perspectives from an outsider? You know, in my own journey, like I remember not long into our marriage, I've been married 28 years, and not long into our marriage, I realized that I was driving my wife bonkers because of some of the patterns in my relational style. And I wasn't aware of it. I didn't know that I was over-processing things, that I was insistent on talking about issues until they were finally resolved at her great expense. And it took quite a while for her to keep reminding me and helping me see that some of my patterns in relational style just weren't matching with her needs. And so that self-awareness is a key part of my book, Relational Triumph. Without it, we can't change. We can't deal with those blind spots until we're ready to understand who we are. And, you know, some people, they come to my office and they want a quick answer. They want me to give them, like, a formula. And instead, I often say, look, let's stop trying to change this, and instead let's try to understand this.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if you met someone and go all the way back 28 years ago and you met your wife, and the two of you sat down and you started to fall in love, you started to get into a relationship, and maybe, hypothetically, the way that you receive love is maybe a wink, a look, a tone of voice, expression, something like that, and maybe the way she receives love is you buy her something. So you're going through life, and and you're winking at her, and your tone of voice is there, and you're doing everything you can to show her that you love her. And one day, 5 years later, you walk into the house and her bags are packed. And you look, and you say, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Well, I'm leaving." "Why are you leaving?" "Well, you don't love me." "What do you mean I don't love you? You don't show me." And what we've done is given them love in every way we've learned how, but it's not the way that they've learned to receive. And wouldn't it be interesting if you could go all the way up front with that and just ask the question? And now you know. And if you don't know, then it's going to give you thought to find out what it is that causes you to feel that you're loved. And when you got a handle on that, a lot of problems that would have happened are stopped before they even happen.
Yeah. Oh, you hit it on the nail. Like, that's so true, Michael. I find that we're slow to express what it is that we really need. Perhaps sometimes we don't even know how to verbalize it.
Yeah.
You know, and people want to rescue the other, so they kind of wait it out and think, well, the other person needs to show me my love in my love language, and I'm not going to tell them how to do it. I'm going to wait until it comes out of them naturally. And like you said, 5 years later, maybe it's too late, right? Whereas learning how to express the matters of a person's heart, I mean, that's just the key to making a successful relationship, to having triumph. Now, it is work. There's no question. There's
sure.
Umph in triumph. You know, and for some people, it's a big risk to be able to sit down with their husband or their wife and say, "Look, honey, when you do this, I realize that, you know, you bring home these flowers for me, and that's nice and all that, but what I really want is to go for a long walk and just share my heart and have you listen and ask those great questions about, you know, how did that make you feel?" and stuff like that. And until we really learn to help each other understand our needs, there's great possibility of missing those opportunities, for sure.
You know, Jerry, what triggered that thought in me, that was sometime back, a couple of years ago probably, there was a woman on the show, and she wrote a book called The First Kiss. You can make it or break it on that first kiss. And what it came down to, the core message in there was, we don't know how the other person likes to be kissed, and nobody ever asks. So if you would take the time and start out with, "How do you like to be kissed?" Now, you know, we're guys. We're supposed to know. Nobody's, you know, we're not going to ask that question. But yes. And then I thought about it later on and brought it to, what would it be like if you asked somebody, "How do you receive love?" But even at the first kiss, we don't sit down and ask. And the reason we don't ask is, quote unquote, we're supposed to know. And I really believe when people meet each other, you meet somebody and you're not going to let them know who you are. You're going to let them know who you think they want you to be. And you're doing this, you get into a relationship, and pretty soon you become who you are, and they don't like that person. And you don't understand why they're leaving, they're walking out, and there's the problem again. It's called be genuine. And there's too many people, Jerry, who are frightened to death to be genuine.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so often it shows up in the bedroom, doesn't it? I mean, I get couples coming in and they talk about their frustrations, and more often than not, eventually one of them will blurt it out and they'll just say, "You know, I'm frustrated with the way he or she does sex." And I love that
topic. It's the same thing. How do you like sex? You know, what do you like to do? You know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, exactly. And you know, you'd be surprised how many people don't understand the nature of the body parts in each male and female. And they can't even look at each other when they're making love, never mind speak to each other, or, like you said, talk about it over a cup of coffee and just discuss that part of their relationship. We invest so much in so many other things in our lives. Like, we will research an automobile that we're thinking of purchasing, you know, to the 10th degree, but do we really spend the time of being sort of an eyewitness and a student of our relationship, our most primary relationship?
See, and there's something out there that it's a misnomer. It's something that gets us all on a wrong track, when the man is supposed to know. I know lots of things, but how do I know about somebody that I meet about what they're like, you know, with intimacy, how they like to be loved? And walking in and just saying, not quite this brazen, but walking in and just, I don't know anything about you. Tell me. And then when I know, I can do things that will make you happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's the fantasy of control. It's like we think perhaps that we know, or the other person should know, and that's a little bit of a fantasy of control that somehow we'll get the reward, we'll get what we want, and we just have to wait long enough for it. And in a sense, that puts us in the victim role, you know, where we wouldn't necessarily have to be in that victim role if we learned how to communicate clearly. But when we stop short of sharing our heart, then it's often because we're waiting for the other person to fulfill what we want fulfilled. And by trying to stay in control, we end up losing so much, and we don't have to do that. We can let go of control and learn to be more forthright, learn to be more genuine with each other. And thereby we'll get out of the victim role. We won't be walking around with a sore look on our face going, man, why did he or she mess up so bad?
No, and Jerry, I hear you loud and clear. We're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you and also buy the book?
Yeah. There's a couple of websites. My business website is riverbendcounseling.ca, and my book's website is relational-triumph.com. And on relational-triumph.com, you can purchase the book. It comes in hardcover, paperback, and also electronic copy.
Wonderful. Jerry, thank you so much for joining us. And again, one more time, slow with that website where we can find the book at.
Relational-triumph.com. Relational-triumph.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Jerry, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael, thanks for having me. Love your show, and especially the provocative title, Dresser After Dark.
Thanks a lot. Take care. Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
The world can hurt us long as we're singing our song.
Give me trumpets, legato.
Put some saxes with them.
Strings, pizzicato.
Add some rhythm.
Hey, thanks for listening. And if you're listening on the web, tell your local radio station about the show. That's the way we grow. And that's what you call networking. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Long as we're singing.